A Texas representative is leaving the state house's ultra-conservative group. What the move could say about the upcoming Texas legislative session, today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. The Texas Attorney General is accusing San Antonio's police chief of violating the so-called Sanctuary Cities Law. What happens now? A Texas-based nonprofit has been making big money housing immigrant children. A new investigation explores. Plus, we'll introduce you to U.S. Representative-elect Veronica Escobar, why she says El Paso is the new Ellis Island. And we'll take a look at 31 of the most powerful people in Texas. You might be surprised, today on The Standard. A high of 57 today in Midland, 46 in Amarillo, 63 in Laredo, and 56 in College Station. I'm Laura Rice. Thanks for spending some time with us for the Texas Standard this Tuesday, December 4th. College Station is preparing now for a presidential burial. News stations there are spreading information about parking and road closures. Texas A&M will be closed on Thursday when President George H.W. Bush is interred at his library there on campus. Public schools will release early. Elsewhere, a check of the headlines, Hail to the Chief, topping the Houston Chronicle. Here lies a great man in the Dallas Morning News. Other papers getting back to more local news. The cost of a jail in Wichita Falls, board nominations in Denton. The focus on the death of the 41st president means you might have missed this late Friday. State Representative Jeff Leach, a Republican from Plano, sent a message to the Texas House Freedom Caucus saying he would no longer be a member of the group. Part of his statement read that he, quote, decided that I want to recommit myself entirely to the House Republican Caucus, to working diligently with all of our fellow Republicans in the House. So what does this do to the makeup of the Texas legislature about to kick off next month? For more on that, we're joined by Ben Philpott. He's senior editor at our home station, KUT Austin. Ben, thanks for swinging by the studio.
Hello.
Let's start with a bit of history. What is the Freedom Caucus and when did it start?
Well, the Freedom Caucus goes back to the U.S. Congress. There's a Freedom Caucus, a member, an organization with several members up in Washington, D.C. These are more hardline, more far-right Republican candidates who have essentially been pushing what they consider the inadequately conservative Republicans to do more and more conservative things, to pass more and more conservative bills, to not do things that Democrats want to work with them on. And a group of Republicans here in Texas decided before the 2017 legislative session that they wanted a state version of the Freedom Caucus. And so they created one.
So pretty new here in Texas. You said pushing conservative issues. What are some of the central missions that they were pursuing last session?
Well, I think if you're an opponent of the Freedom Caucus, you would argue that their central mission is to just not pass bills, to just throw bombs in the middle of the lawmaking process and not allow things to pass. You really saw this happen in the last session when the legislature does these bill days where they have local and consent calendars. Now, these are bills that only focus on local areas. They are bills that only affect a small part. These are all bills that also usually have just consent approval. People are like, oh, it's not controversial. Sure, we'll pass it. This group, the Freedom Caucus, ended up killing an entire day's worth of local and consent bills because they said that these bills were not really going through the correct legislative process. They were spending state money without good debates. They were just they were mad about their own bills, their own regular bills, also not making it to the floor of the House for a vote. And so they decided they were going to just destroy, you know, a couple hundred local and consent bills on that day. And these are things that, you know, the local districts, the local lawmakers were really hoping and expecting to pass during the session. As far as what they're for, they absolutely push for reduction of taxes and regulations and cutting the state budget. They are also opposed to any and all funding of Planned Parenthood, and they would like to see an end to all abortion facilities here in the state of Texas. They're also for what they call constitutional carry, which is just the ability to carry a handgun without any kind of training or licensing. Mm-hmm.
So what does the departure of Representative Leach mean? And do you think more will follow?
I think it means that Leach realized he lives in a Texas suburb. Mm-hmm. He's a representative from Plano. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans just got their butts kicked in Texas suburbs this last election, including places like Tarrant County, Hays County, Williamson County here in Central Texas, all places that have been voting for Republicans and were kind of the base for the Republican Party, that suburban vote. The Republicans just got their tails kicked and in this last election. Leach won his reelection by about 1,600 votes there in Plano. And, you know, if the trends continue, he'll have an even closer election next time around. You know, this is maybe a way of him trying to say, oh, those suburban Republicans that I've said are not really conservatives, huh? They're now the ones that are maybe not going to vote for me anymore. So I think that this is a self-preservation strategy, honestly.
What are we hearing from other members of the House Freedom Caucus about this departure?
Well, I mean, there have been a couple of comments just, you know, well, we appreciate Leach for his efforts. We're going to continue to work with him. And, you know, I've heard a couple of people say, well, you know, how can someone who has been part of a bomb-throwing group, essentially, in the legislative process, how can they kind of reinvent themselves to be some kind of more moderate, you know, work across the aisle type of person? And I think the answer is you can reinvent yourself. A person can reinvent themselves however they want. It's whether or not the people around them are willing to accept that change in personality. And I think we're going to have to see what happens in the legislative session. The Freedom Caucus absolutely mucked up the way the legislature works. They made many enemies on the Republican side and, of course, the Democratic sides. And, you know, we'll have to see if those lawmakers are willing to accept a new Jeff Leach.
Ben Philpott is senior editor at KUT Austin. Ben, thanks.
Thank you.
On Friday, Texas, under the leadership of State Attorney General Ken Paxton, sued the city of San Antonio for violating the state's controversial anti-sanctuary cities law. The lawsuit focuses on the San Antonio Police Department and its chief, William McManus, saying he ordered the release of immigrants in a high-profile case, and that was in violation of the law still often referred to as Senate Bill 4. Here to help us break down the state's actions is University of Houston political science professor Brandon Rottinghouse. Brandon, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, Laura.
What does the state say San Antonio did to violate Senate Bill 4?
Well, in effect, the Attorney General is suggesting that a state investigation has found that the police chief in San Antonio skirted the protocol by ignoring Homeland Security's request to investigate the particular matter in question, which was that they had discovered a group of migrants who were being transported in a tractor trailer. The state suggests that the chief essentially called a private entity to assist with taking the aliens away, as opposed to Homeland Security. And at this point, they're still apparently a security risk. So it's a political hot potato that results from, like you said, the remnants of SB 4, which are still being litigated.
Let's talk about that, because after the law was passed, it was challenged by some municipalities, and I understand a federal appeals court upheld most of SB 4. So could Texas actually have a case here?
This is the first time that SB 4 has been challenged by the state, so the case needs to be clear-cut. To some degree, it looks clear-cut. I mean, the ICE enforcement agents have suggested that essentially that the police chief did err by not letting them handle the investigation. The local police union in San Antonio has suggested that the disciplinary action should be taken against the chief. So there are some issues there that make it look like it's a credible legal case. But as you say, there are still some litigation that's ongoing on this, and it could be that this is some place where the state and this local entity, San Antonio, fight over it. So there's still some litigation ongoing, but this case in particular could be a test case for that.
Attorney General Paxton is clearly hoping to send a warning to other cities with this lawsuit. Do you think this serves that purpose?
I think that it does. And it's interesting because it shows that the Republicans aren't backing down from this fairly hardline position on immigration. Now, the case, of course, plays out in the context of this discussion nationally about what the president likes to call an invasion, but which other people are calling certainly less than that. And Republicans licking their wounds after the 2018 elections. I mean, political clout is like a block of ice. It's going to melt pretty quickly. And the Democrats, I think, are going to try to push back on SB 4 on some of these issues, even considering that the Republicans don't seem like they're going to back down.
Do you think we should expect to see more of these state versus local lawsuits in regard to SB 4? Or do you think that the state will wait to kind of see how this one plays out?
I suspect that we're going to see this as the kind of test case to determine how far things will go. I'm sure that politically that several more of these cases will be flagged because these are definitely things that the Republicans have put a lot of investment into and which their base really approves of. So we're going to see some of that. But we're also going to see the Democrats push back. The legislative session is likely to see some exceptions attempted to be carved out of SB 4, like exceptions for people who were discovered at houses of worship. Democrats have tried to reroute the issue, too. They've been trying to attempt to shine the spotlight on what they call sanctuary industries. These are industries that they say turn a blind eye towards allowing for undocumented immigrants to come in and work. So there is a kind of chess game afoot here. I don't think that either side is really in a position where they're going to lay their king down.
You know, I noticed several other states have come on to join Texas in this lawsuit against San Antonio. What's the purpose there?
It's interesting. This has been a kind of a spur for many other states to enact these kinds of laws. And these other states, of course, are in a similar position as Texas. They're southern states often, and they're looking for political play here to be able to gain some credibility on the immigration issue in a tangible way. I mean, I think a lot of times you see that the kind of rhetoric around immigration doesn't always match reality, but this is a moment and a kind of litigation that could allow those things to link up. So it's something tangible that many people who approve of this kind of policy could point to say that this is a real problem.
Brandon Rodinghouse is a political science professor at the University of Houston. Brandon, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar in the studio with me now. He's watching what folks are talking about on social media here in Texas.
Hi, Laura. Yeah, staying with the state legislature a moment longer. New signs a controversial Confederate plaque at the Texas Capitol building, which falsely says slavery was not an underlying cause of the Civil War, could soon come down. Here's what we know. The plaque put up there in 1959 by the Children of the Confederacy claims the war between the states was not a rebellion, nor was its underlying cause to sustain slavery. This has been controversial with several lawmakers. Now, Governor Greg Abbott has appointed a state board empowered to remove the plaque to meet January 11th, and also presumptive House Speaker Dennis Bonin. He also says he supports removing it. So signs this could be afoot when the legislature reconvenes or prior to their reconvening. Mm-hmm. Lots of folks talking about it on our Facebook page there. Tim Bauer-Kemper says, think for one second what was starting to happen in 1959 when people decided this thing needed to go up. People long oppressed were standing up to claim rights that white America didn't want to give them. The rebel flag got drug out of storage to intimidate and refuse their humanity. This has no place in our capital. Just some of the reaction we're seeing out there, Laura. I'll be back with more later in the show.
You can always share your thoughts in our Modern Letters to the Editors segment, our social media segment. We'll also join back here in a little bit.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. A study released in April brought widespread attention to the problem of college student poverty. While the stereotypes lead us to believe college students are constantly binging on beer and pizza, turns out more than one in three say they worry about where their next meal will come from. The same percentage also worried about affording housing. For a couple of years now, San Antonio College has been offering a program to meet the needs of students living in poverty. Administrators say the Student Advocacy Center has helped hundreds with the goal of keeping them on track to complete a degree. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips has more.
When social work faculty member Lisa Black launched the center 2 years ago, the college knew, anecdotally, it was needed. But Black says they didn't know how common it was for students to be unsure where their next meal was coming from until there was a place they could go for help.
And quite honestly, for many faculty members, it's a relief. It's very hard when so much of your success is measured by, you know, are the students making decent grades? Are they dropping from your class? It's tough for a faculty member to help with needs that they're not trained or equipped to help with.
More than 70 students a day use the center's grab and go in the lobby of its new building. It's stocked with snack items like cereal and noodle cups that students can take without answering questions. Around 160 students a month fill two bags of groceries from the food pantry upstairs.
Students were visiting our pantry because they were hungry that day. So they would burn an entire visit where they can get sustainable food for their families to go home and cook in their kitchen because they had a math test and they hadn't eaten or had a drink of water all day.
According to a 2016 survey, one in four SAC students sometimes go hungry. More than 40% have unstable housing. Last year, the Trellis Company gave the college $25,000 to use as emergency grants. This year, it's been renewed for $30,000.
I've gotten an emergency fund request as low as $17. On average, of the 75 students that we've dispersed to, it's about $300. And it's for all of the things that you can imagine, like rent and utilities.
Black says the center is more than a Band-Aid. It offers ongoing support, from individual counseling to how to build a budget. But at the end of the day, the only real solution for students is earning a degree that allows them to earn a bigger paycheck.
This is their hope. It's the way that I escaped poverty. It's the way that most people escape poverty.
And without the center to help students through a financial crisis, Black says many would drop out to get a second or third job. Others would come to class worried and hungry, and that makes it hard to study and pass tests. In San Antonio, I'm Camille Phillips for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business on Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, ensuring compassionate care for injuries of every size at businesses big and small. Learn more at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. An Austin-based nonprofit focused on housing migrant children is the subject of a New York Times investigation. The new report details a record of poor management and potential financial misconduct. Southwest Key has shelters across the country capable of housing up to 5,000 migrant children. The organization has become a key housing resource for the federal government as thousands of minors and their families have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border this year. Nick Kulish covers immigration for the New York Times and was one of the reporters who worked on this exclusive investigation. Nick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some examples detailed in this report about how Southwest Key and its founder, Juan Sanchez, are, as your team writes, stockpiling taxpayer dollars. How much money are we talking here and how is that happening?
Well, as of last fall, they were sitting on $61 million in cash, which is quite a bit of money, obviously. I think that, you know, they're using a variety of methods. Obviously, they have an enormous federal grants for taking care of kids, $626 million in the past year, $1.7 billion in federal grants in the past decade. But they've really diversified. They've become almost a nonprofit conglomerate with charter schools, for-profit companies, and of course, their original juvenile justice programs.
Do you mind detailing, for those who haven't read your article yet, some of the most egregious things that you found in your investigation?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the more questionable practices was that Mr. Sanchez, his chief financial officer, and a realtor that they work with were the owners of one of the shelters that they were operating personally, not Southwest Key. So they were, in essence, paying themselves rent out of the federal taxpayer grants that were coming to their nonprofit. And that raises some real questions in terms of self-dealing. I think that the loaning of millions of dollars to property developers is an extremely unusual arrangement, to say the least. Also, I think that, you know, we haven't discussed it, but, you know, Mr. Sanchez has paid $1.5 million to operate a charity for children. His chief financial officer is making $1 million. And his wife, Mr. Sanchez's wife, is making $500,000. You know, these are extraordinarily high salaries.
And you compared it to the American Red Cross, which you say is a much larger nonprofit, I guess, though, just to give people an idea of how large the salary is.
Sure, and he's making significantly more than twice what the head of the Red Cross is making. And the, I mean, the Red Cross, you know, is an enormous nationwide charity with that dwarfs them in terms of revenue.
Talk about that for-profit part. I mean, how do they manage all of that and still keep non-profit status? Some of these for-profit arms include something like a florist? How does that even fit into their mission and their goals?
Right. There was a florist. That's true. I mean, if you think of it this way, you think of a nonprofit museum that has a cafe, and they actually do have a restaurant. So there are ways that you can have a for-profit within a nonprofit. And I think that Southwest Key justified a lot of its for-profits as bringing jobs to East Austin. So they have, you know, workforce development and construction and other things. But I think especially when you look at some of the problems that they've had in their shelters, you have to ask yourself whether there's such a thing as diversifying too much and losing track of your core mission.
Lots of immigrant shelters, some of them you point out are not actually owned by the organization. And that's, I guess, led to some of the problems.
Well, I mean, in terms of the ownership of the shelter issue, that really gets to the properties and the lending, where, you know, a lot of smaller shelter operators, they just own their own shelters. It's sort of a strange analogy, but you can think of kind of like a mom and pop. If you have, you know, Sister Agnes's, you know, small shelter and there are, you know, 12 kids in it and they own it. But what Southwest Key has done is loan millions of dollars to property developers to buy buildings and then rent them back to Southwest Key at extremely high costs. It's sort of an odd arrangement, but I think that we're still trying to get to the bottom of why and how that makes sense.
How has Southwest Key responded?
Southwest Key actually has just put out a response, and they have said that Juan Sanchez has said that they are going to have their own independent examination. They're going to hire an outside law firm overseen by their board of directors, and they're supposed to also retain an accounting firm to go through their books and look into some of the practices that we detailed in the story.
Nick Kulish covers immigration for the New York Times. He was part of a team of reporters who investigated Austin-based nonprofit Southwest Key programs. We'll have a link to the investigation on our website, texasstandard.org. Nick, thank you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Great Texas Line Press, publisher of W.F. Strong's Stories from Texas, Some of Them Are True, and independent booksellers like River Oaks, The Twig, and Book People, as well as Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Bucky's.
From the Texas Standard Newsroom, I'm Becky Fogel with a roundup of news from across the state. The U.S. House and Senate have until Friday night to reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program. Sound familiar? That's because Congress has already passed a couple of short-term extensions this year to keep the program up and running. In fact, before the 7-day extension President Donald Trump signed over the weekend, the program was set to expire on November 30th. David Marstead is chief executive for the NFIP. He says he's confident Congress will reauthorize this FEMA program before the deadline, but warns of the consequences of a lapse.
If the program were to lapse, we couldn't sell or renew flood insurance policies or borrow from the U.S. Treasury to pay claims for existing policies.
The NFIP is currently $20 billion in debt. And while the program will always carry some debt as currently structured, Marstead says one way to improve its financial health is by signing more people up for flood insurance, even in flood-prone cities like Houston, where people are already more likely to have this type of coverage.
But still, it wasn't enough. 80% of the properties that were damaged in Hurricane Harvey did not have the necessary flood insurance.
The U.S. Senate has already approved a measure that would extend the program for 6 months, but the House has yet to move on an extension. For the first time ever, the state's top military official will be a woman. Governor Abbott has appointed Major General Tracy Norris to be the next Adjutant General of Texas. KUT's Trey Shar reports.
General Norris has more than 3 decades of military experience, including 2 tours in Iraq. She's also no stranger to Austin's Camp Mabry, the headquarters of the Texas Military Department. Norris has had assignments here 6 times, going back to the early 2000s. The most recent is Assistant Adjutant General, a position Norris has held since the beginning of 2016. At the start of 2019, she'll take over as Adjutant General, the top officer in command of the Texas Army National Guard, Texas Air National Guard, and Texas State Guard. Trey Shar, KUT News.
Peanut production fell more than 40% in Texas this year. There were several factors at play, including fewer planted acres, summer drought, and heavy rains this fall. Dr. Emmy Kimura is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension statewide peanut specialist. She says this is a big drop from 1 year to the next, but she puts this figure into perspective.
Actually, when I look at the past history of planted acres in Texas, our average acres has been around 150,000 to 160,000 acres for a long time, except for the past 2 years.
That puts this year's harvest on par with years past at 155,000 planted acres. That's Look at News from across the state. I'm Becky Fogel for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas Standard headlines comes from Fort Lonesome, Texas-based chain stitch embroidery design and tailor-made custom Western wear on Instagram and at ftlonesome.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice. There's a conversation that Texans have gotten used to having over the years. Someone moves to the state from, say, Wisconsin or Ohio or somewhere in the Northeast, and they say something like, "I just really miss the seasons." Well, handle that situation as you will. A good eye roll is probably not uncalled for. But this year, more than usual, you can also point to some traditional evidence of fall, the changing color of the leaves on the trees. In fact, this year, the leaves have been so colorful in some parts of the state that a listener at our home station, KUT Austin, asked, why? So reporter Mose Bouchel joined him for a little walk. They went out to enjoy the scenery, but if you listen closely, you may also hear the answers to that listener's question.
This one is really beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
We should walk down here a little bit and have a look at it.
It was a gorgeous fall morning when I met Doug Addison, close to Temple Beth Israel on Shoal Creek Boulevard.
And then just enjoying the trees here on the grounds of the temple, and then also along the banks of Shoal Creek.
And the creek here still has some water in it after all that rain we got this fall.
It had been chilly the night before, but as we walked, the sun started to warm us. It's one of those mornings when you're not sure if you really need your jacket or not.
Yeah. Gonna zip it up because we're heading into the shade and the breeze.
And as we walked, the leaves did not disappoint.
That one's a nice orange and yellow color. With its brother next door, with still some green on it.
And so do you know what kinds of trees these are that you're looking at?
I can't really tell what that one is.
It could be, you know, some trees lend themselves to colors more than others.
Sure. I know, I think the elms are really supposed to be doing well with the color this year. But it just seems like all over town, all the trees are getting in on the act. You know, in my 24 years in Austin, I have not remembered quite such vibrant fall colors. And I just wondered, you know, what factors contributed to that.
Okay, so here's the part where I usually call up an expert and try to get answers. But the thing is, Doug thought he probably kind of knew the answers. And I did too. And maybe you do. So instead of doing this the normal way, when I edited this tape of our walk, I kind of put hints in there pointing to them. Now, what we're going to do is rewind the tape, and we'll listen again. This time, with that expert, and with her help, all should be made clear. Let's go.
And then just enjoying the trees here on the grounds of the temple, and then also along the banks of Shoal Creek.
And the creek here still has some water in it after all that rain we got this fall.
Stop. Stop.
This is our expert. Her name is April Rose. She's the Urban Forest Health Coordinator for the City of Austin. And she says that fall rain I mentioned, almost 16 inches in just September and October, has something to do with these colors.
So our trees were very well nourished with water, and that definitely helped them retain their leaves long into the fall when often some of the leaves might have already been dropping.
Why does that matter? Let's get back to our walk. It had been chilly the night before, but as we walked, the sun started to warm us. It's one of those mornings when you're not sure if you really need your jacket or not.
Yeah. Gonna zip it up because we're heading into the shade and the breeze.
Oh, wait a minute.
That's right. The cold weather we talk about is another ingredient. Most trees kept their leaves on into a cold fall.
They were keeping their leaves longer. And so as the temperatures dropped and the chlorophyll, the green pigment, started to break down from the lower temperatures, the leaves didn't fall just yet. And the orange and yellow were able to kind of really shine through before the leaves are going to fall off shortly.
Some even say that juxtaposition between warm day and cold night that I noticed with Doug also helps bring out color. But back to our walk.
I can't really tell what that one is.
Could be, you know, some trees lend themselves to colors more than others. But,
hold on.
I know, I think the elms are really supposed to be doing well with the color this year.
Stop right there.
Here's the last part. It comes down to Austin's tree diversity.
I agree that I've seen that the elm trees have been producing yellow, really brilliant yellow fall color for a couple of weeks now.
But she says there are also a lot more different kinds of trees in Austin these days than there used to be, each with their own different colors. That might be the last reason that in 24 years, Doug says he's never seen this beautiful symphony of foliage.
I've felt the same way. I mean, I look at trees all day, every day, and I am also overwhelmed this year by the brilliance and diversity of colors. Like, it's very spectacular this year.
All over town, all the trees are getting in on the act.
So get out and enjoy, because there's no telling when we'll get another fall like this one. In Austin, I'm Mose Bouchat for the Texas Standard.
We're coming up on 40 minutes past the hour Texas Standard Time. There's more just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to provide mid-market companies a real-time view of their financials, cash, and liquidity while streamlining accounting processes. More at softwareaspromised.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Texas doctors are starting to re-examine their role in preventing suicides among their patients. As Scott Morgan of KETR in Commerce learned, prevention might be as simple as asking a direct question.
Are you thinking of committing suicide? Sound blunt? Well, Dr. Sejal Mehta says that sometimes blunt is the best approach when talking to patients who might be in a bad way.
It's okay to ask questions point blank. And that's where the medical community needs to be comfortable with.
Dr. Mehta is a psychiatrist based in Plano, and she's part of the medical community's efforts in Texas to get general practice medical professionals to be more proactive in identifying patients who are in danger of taking their own lives. And one of the ways doctors can do that is by abandoning the idea that talking about suicide is inherently triggering.
Asking a patient about suicidality does not increase the risk of suicide. On the contrary, asking about it gives patient permission to talk about it.
The Texas Medical Association is leading the push for doctors to better identify at-risk patients. In a recent release, the TMA cited a 2002 study in the American Journal of Psychiatry. That study found that nearly half of all patients who commit suicide saw their doctor within a month before. But Dr. Mehta says seeing an actual doctor is becoming less common, and that could be contributing to suicidal patients slipping through unnoticed.
Many times you are not seeing the doctor. You are seeing mid-level providers or physician extenders, and they are focusing on what the presenting complaint is.
In other words, Dr. Mehta says, physician's assistants are increasingly filling in for overstretched MDs, and these medical proxies often get zeroed into a patient's physical symptoms in order to help keep busy practices moving.
It is very crucial that as a medical community, we ask people how they are feeling. Are they okay? Is everything is going well in their life? Are they not just stomach upset or headache or sinus problem? Overall, as a holistic way, as a whole human being, are they feeling well?
Dr. Mehta says increased training for doctors and their extenders in looking for red flags and answers to those questions could save a lot of lives. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control announced that 47,000 Americans took their own lives in 2017. And Dr. Mehta says so many of those likely could have been prevented if someone at the doctor's office had just asked. and Commerce. I'm Scott Morgan.
The December edition of Texas Monthly has a black and white photo of a nun on the cover. She's smiling and looking slightly upwards. Written above her head and across her body are three words in bright orange bold font: the power issue. The magazine says it's dedicated cover stories to profiling the most powerful people in Texas six times in its history. This time, the cover girl, so to speak, is Sister Norma Pimentel. She's a voice we've featured on the Texas Standard several times, and she's someone Texas Monthly dubs as Patron Saint of the Border. Texas Monthly editor-in-chief Rich Oppel stopped by the Texas Standard studios to talk with host David Brown about the list of 31 Texans taking charge and why they chose Sister Pimentel for the cover.
Well, we've done, as you said, a number of power issues in the past, and they have always focused on political power, to some extent business power. And that really doesn't reflect the totality of Texas. So we wanted to try something new. We wanted to talk about a group of people who lead, who have power in many different kinds of ways, including spiritual power.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Sister Norma does.
Tell us a little bit about what Sister Norma did for those who aren't familiar with her work.
Well, she works for Catholic Charities in the, I think it's called the Respite Center, a refugee center in McAllen. And she basically takes in refugees, migrants from Mexico. What she does is very simple. She provides food, clothing, shelter, a place to shower, a sense to gather with your family, and then look on to the next stop.
Yeah. Obviously, we don't have time to go through every name on this list of 31, but I think some listeners will recognize some of these names. Beyonce, Simone Biles, Beto O'Rourke. How'd you come up with this list in particular? I mean, what was the methodology, if you will?
Well, it's subjective to a large degree. A group of editors sit around and we collect our thoughts on the most interesting people in Texas, people who are having some impact, at least in their kind of walk of life, who have the potential for having a broader impact on the future of Texas. So we have people, yes, some from politics and government, but also from the arts and fashion and higher education and elsewhere. We intended to be provocative.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people will disagree, and they already have.
That's part of the fun of doing a list
that's
like
right.
this, I think.
That's right.
So let's focus on some of these names that folks don't know. Mm-hmm. Graham Weston of San Antonio. Who is he, and do you think people in San Antonio might know that name?
Absolutely. He's the former chair and CEO of Rackspace, which is a big cloud operation there.
Right.
Had a hedge fund as well, sold the company, and since then has been at the center of revitalizing downtown San Antonio, putting in buildings, helping aggregate technology firms.
Tell us a little bit about how Esley Merritt of Dallas is making waves.
Well, Esley Merritt is an African-American, a civil rights lawyer, and got engaged in alleged police brutality cases in Dallas. And so he's very controversial, but he is a vigorous advocate and has gotten quite a reputation.
Another lawyer on the list is Hector De Leon. Who's he?
Hector is a Mexican-American in his early 70s who grew up in East Austin, found that the Democratic Party, in his view, was more exclusive, more to the left of where he wanted to be, and now is active in recruiting Mexican-Americans to the Republican Party, also positions himself to the center in the party or to the left of the Republican Party, in opposition, in a way, to the Tea Party.
If you think about those earlier issues, those power issues, there were a whole lot of white guys in suits.
Yeah.
But was the diversity factor something you were intentionally trying to bring out?
It was intentional. We wanted to make sure that we did not have, as we tended to have in the past, white men in suits. Dan Patrick was on the last cover.
Right, the lieutenant governor.
So we worked hard to identify people of a diverse background, and that was fairly easy to do. There are some very significant, interesting, powerful people from all ethnic and racial backgrounds in Texas.
We've talked about several names here. I wonder if you have a favorite who's made this list?
Michael Sorrells, the president of Paul Quinn College in Dallas. Sorrells came out of the North. I think he's got quite an education, had a prominent job in a prominent law firm in Dallas, but answered the call to take this marginal college that was about to fail and has built it into a quite prosperous, vital Black college.
Mm-hmm. Is there any larger trend as you think about the names and the faces that you feature here, something that sort of speaks to where we are headed in Texas that maybe one could extract from this list?
I think a big, powerful state that is diverse not only in its demographics, but in its pursuits and interests. It's not any longer oil, gas, banking, cattle. It makes its mark nationally and internationally in all sorts of pursuits. So I think we're interested in that.
Rich Oppel is Texas Monthly's editor-in-chief. He's been speaking with us from the Texas Standard Studios about the magazine's latest edition, which includes a list of 31 Texans taking charge. It's the December issue. Texas Monthly, the power issue. Rich, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for stopping by the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Texas is sending 9 new representatives to the U.S. House in January. One of them is Veronica Escobar. She is one of 2 Latinas from Texas to be elected to that body for the first time. The Democrat from El Paso is filling the seat vacated by her longtime friend and ally Beto O'Rourke. He's someone she knew long before he became a political rock star. As Escobar is navigating the halls of Washington ahead of taking office, her hometown and the entire U.S.-Mexico border remain central to much of the conversation on the Hill. So what's that like? Member-elect Escobar joins us now. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
I know you have been asked about it, but I'd love to touch with you on it. Talk to me about what it's like to be the first Latina, one of 2 this year, actually, to represent Texas in Congress.
It's been really extraordinary. You know, when I decided to run for Congress, I didn't do it in order to make history. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it wasn't something that I thought about a lot. But I think what has been most meaningful for me about making history alongside Sylvia Garcia from Houston is that during this very xenophobic, anti-immigrant era under the Trump administration, it was the border that made history. Mm-hmm. It was El Paso, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border that made history during such a troubling year. And for me, it's symbolic because it almost seems like the country is trying to send the antidote to the politics of negativity and division and hatred. And the antidote is the wave of women who are making history. And I am just completely honored to be a part of that wave.
Since Election Day, you've been preparing to take on the job, including spending some time in Washington. How's that been so far?
So we've had 2 weeks of orientation, or as I have called it, freshman disorientation, because it's been really overwhelming. There's so much to learn. There's so many relationships to build, finding a place to live so that while I'm there casting votes, I have a bed to go home to at night, because I absolutely will not sleep in my office the way some members do. Mm-hmm. I will tell you the very first couple of days when we were walking the halls of the Capitol and my husband was with me, I just felt this incredible honor. So many women and men throughout history who've walked those halls, and it reaffirmed for me how fortunate and privileged I am and what a profound responsibility it is.
You voted for Representative Nancy Pelosi as Speaker. How are you feeling so far about the cohesion of the Democratic Party in the House?
I think generally there is a lot of cohesion. You know, what is wonderful, and I think something we should celebrate, is the diversity of voices from, you know, the far left to very conservative Democrats. You know, I absolutely understand the desire for new leadership and for fostering a culture in the Congress where new leadership can rise to the top. And I do believe that Leader Pelosi has heard that loudly and clearly. I really, truly hope that we can come together and deliver the votes that we need to make her speaker. Otherwise, especially without an opponent, especially in the way that things have been done, it makes us less unified. And so I'm really hoping that by the time January 3rd rolls around, there's a lot more unity than exists right now in this moment.
I wanted to also talk to you about El Paso. Of course, the border has been constantly in the news lately, and you caught our attention with something you said a while back about comparing El Paso to Ellis Island. Why do you draw that comparison?
You know, when you look at the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, those words, those very powerful words in that poem, are still so true today. But the folks that are fleeing poverty and violence and persecution in search for opportunity, they are not coming in through the New York Harbor. They are coming in through the southern border. Mm. So, you know, I think we need to remind one another of our history, of our roots, and of how this country was built.
Veronica Escobar is representative-elect for the 16th Congressional District of Texas. Veronica, thank you again.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And listening to your comments or reading them as it is on social media is social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hi, Laura. Well, we're continuing to hear about that story I mentioned at the top of the show, how a controversial Confederate plaque at the Texas State Capitol looks like it may be coming down. The state board with the power to remove it has been convened by Governor Greg Abbott. The incoming speaker, presumptive speaker of the House, also mm-hmm. supports its removal. So we may be seeing this plaque from the so-called Children of the Confederacy, which claims that slavery wasn't the cause of the Civil War, come down soon. And lots of folks are sounding off about it on our Facebook page. Janice Hitchcock says, how about we just be real about the past? My family owned slaves. We also had extremely vocal abolitionists in the family. She goes on to say that the Civil War had many factors, but it was definitely about slavery, and it's time, past time, she says, to own that. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Gregory Brown has a very succinct comment that I find pretty interesting. As the plaque says that the slavery was not the cause of the Civil War, he says, whenever a bronze plaque states what it is not about, that's absolutely the thing that it is about. And that's a very interesting way of looking at it there.
Now, this was also something that came up with the State Board of Education this year, right? I mean, this was something that was a similar issue. I think it was another thing that they had to revise.
Yes, I believe they had like three causes of the Civil War, mm-hmm. and slavery was there in the last of the pack.
So maybe it makes sense to make this change in with both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, definitely so. That's what many people would say. You know, another story from earlier in the show, generating some reaction. Southwest Key, that mm-hmm. is the Austin-based nonprofit holding thousands of detained migrant children, most infamously in that converted Walmart mm-hmm. facility near the U.S.-Mexico border. Mm-hmm. That New York Times investigation, as we learned, quote, has stockpiled taxpayer dollars and possibly engaged in self-dealing with top executives, close quote from that article in the Times. Lots of people sounding off on this one. Beatrice Vera calls the whole operation despicable. She says that we must make sure in this environment, which normalizes the swamp-like behavior of this administration, this behavior does not ever, ever seem normal. And Kim Soto says this about the proprietor of Southwest Key. He sounds like an amazing man with a great life story, but money and power can make people greedy. While he's hardly to blame for the crisis, it's revolting to see how many people will take advantage. And lots of people, you know, and I've heard lots of conversation about this, you know, it's like they are providing the service. Mm-hmm. There's the question, if they did bow out, who else could potentially provide the service? So it's a very complicated issue that's really generating a lot of high emotions on social media there, Laura. Well, shifting gears quickly, Donald Trump making news with tweets There goes the music, though. Maybe I don't have time to get into Tariff Man. Have you heard about Tariff Man?
No, this is new.
Defending his tariffs, and he says, I am a Tariff Man. You can kind of insert your own,
like X-Man or
your own superhero or Iron Man parody or Piano Man parody. Lots of folks riffing on the old Tariff Man out there this Tuesday.
All right, Wells Dunbar, watching all the things on social media. We hope you will weigh in and join us back here tomorrow. See you then.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.
PRI, Public Radio International.